Okay, welcome everybody. We are back after a break, back after a bit of time away from the Academy of Management Origin series, but glad to be back to talk with authors who've got papers in press at Academy of Management, who've worked hard to develop these papers into something that we hope will have a big impact on management theory and just how we think about what we do in the workplace. And so today I'm very glad to be able to speak with Keime Sugiyama, Jamie Ledge, and Gina Doko about their fascinating paper, which I think almost all of us can probably relate to, both in our own capacity and in our interactions with students, MBA students, executives, and maybe even just our spouses and others we work with, because it's about something I think we all grapple with. Stable Anchors and Dynamic Evolution, a Paradox Theory of Career Identity Maintenance and Change. So really grappling, and what it sounds like, grappling with this notion that as we go through our careers, we're going to have some things we anchor on and some things that evolve and change as we go. And so I'm excited to speak with them about the evolution, development of this paper. And just a reminder to those who've listened to this before, and information for those who are listening for the first time, this is where we try and take you behind the scenes of an Academy of Management review paper, where we try and help you understand what's gone on in the development of this paper and how we've gotten to the point of what ultimately appears in press. So thank you to the three of you for being here. Before we jump into actually talking about the paper, perhaps we can just go through and just a brief introduction from each of you in terms of who you are, where you're currently located, how do you sort of frame up your research identity, and then we'll jump into this paper in particular. So Keime, if we can start with you.
Sure. I'm Keime Sugiyama. I'm an assistant professor of management at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. And my main research areas are in diversity, identity, and careers, so different intersections of that.
Awesome. Thank you. Jamie?
Hi, I'm Jamie Ledge. I'm a professor and I'm a group chair in the DeMore McKim School of Business at Northeastern University. My research, similar to Keime's, falls into the areas of diversity, work, family, intersections, and careers, with a common theme of identity streamed throughout all of those.
Well, she referred to, I can't remember the exact term, but basically you were like her rock star that she looked up to.
I was her fangirl. My
kids were fangirl. There you go. So it's not surprising that you're in the same sort of area. Gina, what about you?
I'm a professor at the University of California, Davis Graduate School of Management, and I study careers, primarily the consequences of people's careers and the career choices they make, the things that happen to them in their careers.
Awesome. Thank you. So obviously common theme, which gets brought out in this paper. So maybe you can start off, Keime, by just giving us a sense of what is this paper about? I think there's some hints in the title, but if we peel back one or two more layers, what would be your sort of take on what this paper is about?
So I think it was in our elevator pitch, was almost in the introduction that you gave, which is that we're theorizing this career identifying process. And what this process is meant to explain is how it is that people can have a more stable, coherent sense of self, while at the same time experimenting and also evolving who they are in their career. So a central element of that is this paradox. So we use paradox theorizing, and we're applying the paradox of stability and change within the individual and how they subjectively think of themselves and how do they manage different tensions that arise when they think about who they are in their career.
The paradox at the level of an individual, in the sense that on the one hand, I want to sort of stay the same person and attach to the fact that maybe I'm a professor or if there's something else that's salient to my identity. But on the other hand, as I learn about new technologies or I reframe who I am, I actually begin to shift certain elements of my identity. So is it at that level that you're referring to paradox?
Yeah. And it's kind of how do you keep those different senses of self together to where you're not having a, you know, crisis of identity on an ongoing basis. And so a big part of our theory is to theorize how do people actually manage these tensions and have these different versions of themselves. And so we also talk about how people can separate their sense of self across time, across social space. And this is part of how they manage the paradox. When it gets out of balance, how do you bring it back into balance?
So if I was to push you a little bit further on that, just in terms of, because I think it's so salient and relevant to all of us, what are the sort of insights about how this paradox might be managed, or the perspectives that you put forth in terms of how it might be managed and what the sort of consequences of that are?
Yeah, so our theory really is grounded in real life experience. So Jamie had a student who's kind of the model for the example that we use throughout the paper. And we also had this study that we did together of young professionals. And so we were really curious and surprised at how these young professionals who seemed to have a very stable sense of who they were in their career, seemed to be on a particular path, were planning these dramatic changes. And we were like, that's interesting. And then the opposite was true as well. We had individuals who seemed like a mess and were kind of trying all different kinds of things, but they had this common thread throughout those different changes. So it made sense to them. It was coherent to them. And so we were trying to explain, how can someone do that? How can someone seemingly be a mess, but have a pretty coherent sense of themselves? And then how can someone seem like they have a very clear path they're taking, they're advancing, they're getting promoted? Why wouldn't they stay in that path and take such a big risk, make such an abrupt change? So I think our theory also explains how something that looks abrupt can actually be percolating under the surface. So we use this metaphor when we were kind of working through our theorizing of, the duck on the pond, a pretty common metaphor, I think, that on the surface, you can look like a duck in your career identity, like you're just kind of streaming along, but your legs are doing a lot of this, pedaling. And so paradox actually helped us to theorize that, because part of paradox and the dynamic equilibrium of the different forces that make up the paradox is to be able to make micro shifts. So these little shifts that help us to balance whenever there are tensions and we get kind of thrown off balance a bit.
Yeah. And so in essence, it's actually a lot more evolutionary. These shifts are a lot more evolutionary and less dramatic than they might sometimes seem on the surface, because
right.
There's a lot going on underneath the surface before something radical really happens.
Yeah. And it also accounts for when something seems dramatic. So, a layoff, for example, and certainly there's dramatic impacts to someone's life that way, but it's possible that it might not impact their career identity all that much if they just end up back on track doing the same kind of work that they were doing before in their next position. Or in the paper, we also have the example of retirement. If that was something that was expected, that may not necessarily be a big change in your career identity, even though it may be a substantial change in terms of your career path.
Yeah. So you sort of started to allude a little bit there to how it got started. And there were both you're engaging in research in this area, and there's this sort of salient example that comes out, and it may actually end up being multiple people who serve as these examples. But can you tell us a little bit about sort of the point to which you developed to say, okay, I think this could be an AMR paper, and let's start to begin to develop it into something that might be seen as new theory or a development of theory that could ultimately land up in AMR?
I think it was this idea of tensions that did really draw us all in. And how can we theorize how people grapple with those tensions? How do people, get unstuck in their careers? And so I think that was some of what was a common interest. Jamie, Gina, I don't know if you want to chime in about what really struck you about the paper that kind of got us going.
I can say so. Oh, Jamie, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to tag on to the story of Julie. And that was a very striking story for us, when we were talking about this example. But I remember this person coming to me on several occasions for career advice And this was a person who had the career path that everyone in a business school wants to see, you know, your the professors, the administration on a really high level career path. And the person was saying all along, this is not who I am. This is not how I see myself. And yet it was so, as Kemei said, it was so salient to this person's, at least on the surface, also on the outside, not just from what they talk about, but even how people present themselves, whether it's on LinkedIn or on their resumes, we are conditioned to highlight to people that our careers are very linear, even though we often reward people for having an entrepreneurial type of career. So I think that was the thing that really got us sort of excited about thinking about this idea that we're supposed to tell people to be entrepreneurial and have this entrepreneurial spirit, but we also reward them for, you know, this stable linear career path.
Yeah. What drew you in, Gina?
Well, for me, it was really very personal because I've made like a very large career. I've made several large career changes myself. Most notably, I was a manager for about 15 years before I went back for a PhD and went into academia. And it looked crazy from the outside, right? This huge change. But when Kemei and Jamie started talking to me about the tensions and the push and pull of these different, you know, sort of forces, this staying on path versus wanting to evolve, it spoke to me so personally. And I thought, yeah, that's exactly what happens. Yeah, let's think about, you know, what it really means theoretically. It was a really exciting set of ideas, I think. And so I was so happy when I was asked to join this project. Yeah.
So you've got the story of Julie, and just for those who are listening, Julie is a pseudonym or a fictitious name for a real person whose story comes through in the paper, and who clearly inspired and sort of evolved or helped reflect some of the thinking in the paper. You've got sort of personal interests in studying careers and studying identity and careers. You've got your own personal journeys and so on. When did you anchor on the idea of paradox being sort of a useful theoretical anchor to begin to frame up some of this stuff and become part of the story? And how did you sort of get your head around the idea that paradox could be useful for this?
Well, we really have to thank our review team. We had the idea of tensions in the paper, and we were kind of hinting at this both and, but we weren't really fully embracing it. So we really have to thank AMR and the developmental approach that the review team took, and our wonderful editor, Abby Shipp, who really shepherded us and kind of encouraged us to look at paradox a little bit more closely. And then when we did, we realized, oh, actually, this does help us to explain a lot of the things that are still unclear and that we haven't really explicitly theorized yet. So we really do, want to thank the review team for pushing us and encouraging us to be clearer about that. And paradox was a great way to theorize around that.
And getting your head around paradox, so they come out and they say, well, paradox could be an interesting sort of lens to think about this. Did you just go and sort of read the work on paradox and sort of think about how it evolves? Just help, because I think a lot of people often when they write a conceptual paper or even the front end of an empirical paper, someone says, well, this seems like it could be explained with this lens or this perspective might help. And it might not have been a perspective that was front and center initially. How did you equip yourself to bring it into the paper in the way that you have, just for the sake of others that might be pushed to do that?
Well, I think one common theme among us is that Jamie and I are qualitative researchers, and Gina also has done qualitative research. Although I don't know if Gina would call herself a primarily qualitative researcher.
No, I'm primarily a quantitative researcher.
But she has a wonderful AMJ that's a qualitative paper. Yeah. So I think that background is helpful because I think that often happens for qualitative research is, you know, you go in, you have a certain way that you've started to build a theory. A review team comes in and says, I'm not sure I see that in your paper, but this is where we see some of the golden nuggets. So I think having had that background with all three of us was helpful because we were like, oh, yeah, that is kind of interesting. Let's try that. Jamie has a Paradox paper in AMJ, so was kind of familiar with Paradox. I had just had like a interest in Paradox before, although I hadn't necessarily published anything. And so I had dabbled a little bit in the Paradox literature, so I was kind of familiar and knew kind of who the main people are in Paradox. And so it just naturally seemed to, make a lot of sense from interests that may not have been, explicit in the paper, but the review team helped encourage us toward that direction. Do you all have anything else to add?
Yeah, I knew almost nothing about Paradox. I mean, really almost nothing. And it can be sort of a set of theory that seems on the surface to be a little bit loose and a little bit, what does it actually mean, right? But once I started reading in the Paradox literature, it just made a lot of sense. The review team's suggestion, Abby's suggestion to really focus there, really made a lot of sense once I started digging into it. And I got a lot of respect for that literature and that set of theory. It started to be really quite exciting. But I think, one of the things that comes up as we're talking about this is it's so much work, right? You're really reading in a new literature. And I think you really have to do that and engage with it seriously. So it's not something that can be done on the fly, not something that can be done like sort of quickly. We take our time with it, and we took our time with it, and it was necessary.
And integrating with other literatures too, especially when someone like me and Kemi, our heads are really in the identity space. And so it's hard to break free of that and think about how other literatures can join forces.
And that's often where the opportunities lie in writing a conceptual piece is, almost creating these clashes between different literatures. And I think that's what comes out nicely here. You've got the identity piece, which I suspect that's sort of what you started with, and the identity literature. And then someone sort of says, well, these tensions could be represented by a paradox. You've got to go deep into some of the paradox stuff. And I love the way you said it. You don't do this quickly, because for many outsiders, paradox on the surface, well, two things that are sort of opposing in forces that seem simple. And so you've got to dig deep into that and really understand what are the nuances of this theory, and then what happens when we bring them together. And that's often where the exciting stuff happens. One of the things I really appreciated about the paper when I looked at it was your ability to illustrate your ideas using visual depictions that sort of bring together a lot of different ideas in a fairly simple but not overly simplistic way. Can you talk to us a little bit about what did it take to develop these figures? Because just for the sake of the audience, there's a figure one, a figure two, and then figure three A, B, and C. And so all of them sort of add a different piece of the puzzle of the overarching story of the paper. And I'd just be interested to know sort of the back process, back end process to developing these. At what stage did you develop them? How did they evolve as your paper evolved? Just talk to me a little bit about that.
I think Jamie and Gina are smiling because this is like my favorite part of theory building is playing with models. So every meeting, we had very intense meetings, which were fun, they were great, but we would be on Zoom and I'd be on, it was PowerPoint. Some people are surprised to learn that it's not some fancy, software. We were literally just playing with PowerPoint and moving things around, and I do it real time as we were talking. Well, maybe the arrow goes this way, or Mary, maybe we want more of a feedback arrow here. But the model certainly evolved a lot. It's very different from where we started. And I think this is where our strengths balanced each other out, because I tend to be the one that just adds all the things Like all the, shouldn't there be another feedback error here and another feedback error here and here and here? And then Gina is more of a, you know, let's go for parsimonious, simple, you know, the more errors we have, the more we have to explain too. So I really, really appreciated Gina's role in kind of reining in all the foxes and arrows. And so, yeah, it was very, very collaborative, very much done in real time as we were taking into consideration the comments from the review team and reworking things. And I don't know how many different versions of the model we had, 30, 40 models at least. Yeah.
Yeah, it's intriguing to me that you're obviously all three are in different parts of the country, different time zones, different everything. So I suspected you probably did it, the majority of this work virtually. To be able to do this level of sort of visualization, it seems to me like this would have all been done on a whiteboard, but you say, no, you're actually willing to, in real time, play with PowerPoint on, I suspect, on Zoom or on Microsoft Teams and just make it all happen.
Actually, well, even when Keme and I were together, probably for part of it, when she was in Boston as a postdoc, it was COVID. So we hardly ever saw each other.
Yeah,
we were on Zoom the whole time anyway.
Yeah.
But it does speak to the fact that we spent a lot of time on Zoom together. We met a lot for this paper. Co-author team, I think that's the way, like when I work on quantitative projects, sometimes like somebody does the front end, somebody does the back end, that kind of thing. But in a theory paper, you really can't do that. So we were sort of all in all the time. We spent a lot of time in calls together.
And I actually think that is one of the biggest shifts for people who've traditionally done, it's certainly quantitative researchers who've traditionally done primarily empirical work. I think qualitative researchers often need to talk through things in much greater detail, and there's lots of back and forth. But one of the massive shifts to writing a conceptual paper is that a lot of the breakthroughs, ideas, insights are generated in conversation, in people spending time together. And so you've got to find the space and opportunity and not feel like you're wasting each other's time by sitting on Zoom, bouncing ideas off each other, but actually that's moving projects forward. And so I'm glad that you sort of highlighted that, because anyone who's maybe been trained in a very particular way might be more used to this sort of pass it off to the next person and pass it off to the next person. And we all just put the jigsaw puzzle together, as opposed to this much more messy, collaborative, let's bounce ideas, let's have 40 PowerPoint slides that each build on one another. And so I think that's super useful.
Yeah, I think we have writing sessions too, where we had on Zoom, share screen, and we wanted to get precise. I mean, Gina's so awesome at precise language. So we would be on Zoom together and we'd actually do some writing together too on Zoom.
Yeah. So we're starting to learn about all your superpowers here, the team superpowers. The one is creating figures and diagrams, the other precision in writing. So Jamie, we've just got to uncover yours.
Yeah.
Can you talk to us a little bit about, so you've already alluded to the fact that, you know, this was a somewhat developmental R&R process. You were sort of pushed to do more work, to incorporate ideas that you might have thought about but not fully incorporated. What did you find worked well for you in revising a conceptual paper, and what sort of might have changed substantially or what came out as a result of engaging in a somewhat developmental revision process?
Well, I think our editor, Abby Shipp, has such a wonderful way of writing decision letters. I mean, it was so clear. It was just the right balance of giving us enough direction, but then also presenting us with options. You could go in this direction, you could go in that direction, so that we didn't feel like we were tied to doing any particular thing, but we got enough direction that we were like, okay, we have a sense of, you know, at least how we can consolidate everything and move forward. This is much more tactical, but I have used it ever since. Gina has this wonderful way of putting together a table where you pull in the editor's comments and the reviewer's comments that kind of match up, put them together, and then, you know, start to formulate some responses. So I found that really helpful, and I've used that with every R&R since, because I think it's just such a great way to, you know, you already kind of have some initial responses, and then you go back and tweak things as you're working on the paper and a few things change. But there's kind of that initial, you know, okay, yeah, these are the ways that we're starting to address the reviewer comments. And it was a great way for us to be on the same page, too. I don't know if either of you have anything.
So I just wanted, before we go any further, I want to double click on this tactical notion. This is one of the things people struggle with most.
Yeah.
And to me, it's devastating when someone gets an R&R and just struggles to deliver. And it's always going to happen. But I think the more we can reveal about sort of tactical, practical things that can work in that setting, the more we can almost evolve and develop as a field. So Gina, can you just give us a sense of just the basic mechanics of what this mechanism in the form of a table looks like and how you use it?
Well, it's just, you know, the editor's comments and then tying it to which reviewer's comments it draws from, that kind of thing, and just making sure that all of these things are in the same place so you see them all together and come up with a coherent response, right? So however you want to do it is fine. It's just about making sure that you are seeing the review process as a whole and not as these sort of editor, reviewer one, reviewer two, reviewer three, right? And the more complex the revision, the more important it is to sort of lay it out cleanly, because ours were very complex revisions. We had three very engaged reviewers, and they had a lot to say. And so these were very complicated responses. Don't you think that's right?
I actually wrote that down, and I wanted to bring that up. Engaged reviewers. I think that was Abby's actual terms that she used. And I don't know how many pages of reviews that we had. I think it was at least 20 pages. I don't even know what our response was. Gina's tactical approach to putting that into a essentially a spreadsheet, and then Keme added a column for who does what. And that was just helpful. Even if we didn't have our answers completely articulated in that column, we had some formulation of how we were going to address each of these issues in a, you know, kind of more coherent way. So I think I see a lot of people try to address every single reviewer comment one by one by one. And you can't do that when you have three engaged reviewers that wrote, you know, 4 to 5 pages each of feedback.
No, absolutely. I haven't done it in that format before, but now that I think about myself in the role of an associate editor, you know, my comments are drawn from the reviewer comments, and hence there is a hierarchy and a connection there. And if you can line up, and sometimes there can be two reviewer comments that are very similar or somewhat the same. So if you can line up all of those and come up with a response that tackles them all, as opposed to responding to one, then coming to the next, responding to the next. Sometimes you might copy and paste. Sometimes you might forget to, and then responding. So it seems to make a lot of pragmatic sense. And when you say it, it sounds blatantly obvious. And yet I bet if we did a survey of how many people are doing that, it would be not that many. So thank you for sharing that. And then the other comment I want to make is on the engaged reviewers. I don't think, and I hope she doesn't mind me saying this, but I don't think I've ever met someone who takes so long finding the right reviewers for a paper as Abby Shipp. She told me about her process awesome. Once, and she's yeah. very, and I think this is where associate editors can really make a difference is, who are the best people to review this paper? And I think that was her superpower. So I'm glad you picked up on it.
We're so grateful for the time that the reviewers spent on this. They really did engage with the paper, and it was wonderful. It really was.
Yeah. really was. I think one other thing that was really helpful for us was Abby was willing to meet with us. And so just, you know, even the exercise, we would put together these one pagers and then we'd have, you know, the revised model. And I think that exercise too was so helpful because we had all these revisions and then we kind of had to distill it down to one page that we could send to Abby and then we talked to her about it. So I think that might be another thing that could be helpful to others is, well, I guess first to know that there are editors who are willing to meet with you and talk with you. And one of our main questions in those meetings was, have we retained what the review team was interested in and liked about the paper? Because we don't want to revise it so much that we lose that. So that was, you know, one of our main questions that we posed to her in those meetings. And to just get her kind of reactions to, you know, the revision so far, I think was also very helpful. So we're very grateful to Abby for being willing to spend the time to do that with us.
Awesome. I think we all talked about this, not with Abby, but I think it felt like she was a co-author in some respects, not because she was guiding us in any way possible, but just because she helped us to really, you know, for each revision, she really did a good job in her letters and, you know, in interacting, you know, with us on what we needed to do. So it was, you know, and I think we perceived her to be positive. She was not outwardly positive, but I think we told ourselves that this was a positive feeling that she may have had toward the paper. So I think you have to tell yourself that too, because you can lose confidence very easily in, you know, a very complicated conceptual piece like this.
100%. And maintaining that confidence and that willingness, intrinsic motivation to want to keep going is a big part of being able to push a paper over the line. It's so easy to get discouraged, 20 pages worth of comments about your paper. And so, you know, trying to read into what the editor sees, why they've given an R&R, what do they see in this, and try and make sure you deliver on that, I think is hugely valuable. Can you talk to me a little bit about sort of where this paper can go or where it has gone or what you hope it might inform and launch? I think it's, you know, it's the kind of paper where if you read it, you're not going to see the world, your world and others' world in the same way again. And so I think it impacts people who read it probably personally, but beyond just it impacting how people reflect on their own careers, What impact do you hope it has from a research standpoint or even from a practitioner, leadership development, executive coaching kind of standpoint, and maybe even broader than that, you know, expanding into other domains? I'd love to get your thoughts on what does it set a platform for next?
So I think in terms of research, one of the recurring things that we talked about, and it's in one of the very first sentences of the paper, is that occupation is not necessarily equivalent to career identity. So I think thinking about career identity in that way is impactful for research, and being able to expand on this, you know, career identifying process is something that we hope others kind of pick up, especially the way in which time is considered in terms of career identity, because I don't think there is enough time theorizing in the careers research. It does tend to be kind of more static career types and emphasizing more of the anchoring aspect of career identity. So for research, I think that's kind of one of the main takeaways that we hope people come away with.
I just want to double click on that, because that struck me between the eyes when I read it and I thought about it. I thought, you know, in this day and age where someone can be employed as a, I don't know, as a consultant, yet they're got a podcast that they're running and they're developing expertise in this area and they're writing up blog posts on LinkedIn and they're attending conferences for something else that they're doing. Really, if you just classify them by the occupational label, you're not capturing how they're probably seeing themselves and how they're thinking about their impact on the world. And so this distinction between occupational identity and career identity, I think probably there's more glaring differences, or the potential for more glaring differences to more today than there's ever been. And so that really struck me.
Great, wonderful. Yeah, I think practically, I think it's really helpful for anyone who mentors others around their career too. Jamie mentioned, you know, we do expect people to have this very concise elevator pitch for who they are in their career, and just kind of to be able to say, it's okay that things are kind of messy. That's actually a very functional and productive part of developing your career identity, I think, is a different way to think about it. You know, before I started my faculty career, I worked in consulting, and that was sort of the expectation. You have this very structured career path. If you meet the CEO in an elevator, you should be able to concisely say who you are, what you want to do next. And so just allowing for some of that messiness, I think, is a really great practical implication. Gina and Jamie, do you have other things to add?
I mean, there's so many things that come to mind. I don't even know where to start. I took so many notes. I don't know why, but I always think to my 20-year-old son, who is very entrepreneurial. I hate it. Although I love an entrepreneur. I mean, I love the idea of that, but I also want him to have stability. So I'm experiencing the paradox for somebody else, or I'm having the paradox, even though it's not my career, it's his, but I know he's an extension of me. And obviously I'd like him to be independent at some point in his life. But I think there's so many different ways you can think about this. One of the other ways this project evolved, when we initially collected data that was related to another paper, that messiness that Kemi talked about really was salient, because I had one semester students interview alums, and they wrote papers about their career experiences, and they were horrified. These are not the kind of alums that we should be having. They don't know what they're talking about. They're all over the place. They're saying they want to do this and that. And I kept trying to explain to them, not everybody's career, you know, especially early on, you know, goes in the way that we expect it to. And the same will probably happen for you, even though that's, you know, kind of a scary thing. So I think, you know, one of the reasons why we labeled this a model of career identifying is because we were struck by the idea that career identity is anything but static. I mean, it might be at short little points in time, but really it's always evolving. I mean, even just a simple, I don't know, a Facebook post or even our conversation among ourselves right now may trigger us to think about and trigger our career identity or that process to continue to evolve.
Yeah. I think Jamie used the term messy, or word the messy more than any other word. That word came up so often, but it's such a great word to think about your career in terms of. And I think, you know, both Kemi and Jamie have so much expertise in understanding career narratives and sort of how narratives are constructed. And it is this idea of, you know, what happens before they're constructed, right? They're a big, messy mess. And then you put some retroactive, you know, sort of sense to it and do some retroactive sense making. But when you're living in the moment, there is this kind of messiness where you are pulled by these tensions. But that doesn't mean you're crazy and schizophrenic. That is a normal part of an evolving career. So I think that's important for a lot of people to know, parents in particular, right?
Parents, MBA teachers who try to counsel students, all these different situations. And our academic career is exactly the same. We do the same thing. We study all these different things and then retrospectively put them in a bucket and try and make sense of them. So absolutely fascinating research. I want to end off with this question, and I want you just each to chime in if you can. And the essence of the question is, what one bit of advice would you give to someone who's starting off trying to write an AMR paper for the first time? So it might be based on some experience you've had on this project or on another project, but if there is something that comes from evolving this project, what lesson did you learn that you think others would be able to find valuable? And you can tie it back to something specific, or just give it out as a general sort of insight or perspective.
I think a practical piece of advice is to use your FTE, Greg, on the nuts and bolts. I have found that so helpful, and I've found that doctoral students have found that so helpful in terms of here's where you can start. Here's a process that you can use just to kind of get started. If you have an interesting idea and you want to just try and see what the potential is there and if you can develop it into a novel contribution. So that's one practical piece. We kind of talked about the psychological aspect of it, but I think it is just, you know, not to give up and surround yourself with wonderful co-authors who also don't give up on you, you know? I mean, we really did. We went through the pandemic with this paper together. And so, you know, both Jamie and Gina were such a support throughout this whole process. And it is hard. I mean, there were definitely days where I was dreaming models and this paper was really taking over a lot of cognitive space. And so I think having strong relationships to get you through the process too, at least for me, was very valuable. And it was an enjoyable experience because I had such great people to theorize with.
And awesome. Just so you know, shout out to Kemi, because she and I were working on several revisions at the same time that were just as complex as this one. So the fact that she led us to success is just amazing. So kudos to her.
So one of the critical factors is to have a lead author or a project lead that has their ducks in a row, is able to keep momentum going on whatever they're working on and keep everyone else in line, which is a critical role to play in these projects.
Yeah. And just to add to the practical advice that Kemi mentioned about your piece, I think just finding an AMR that you love, it's always helpful, even just understanding the structure of that, but just the flow of it, because I think it can be really hard to pull all the pieces together for a theory paper. And using a paper as a recently published paper that you really enjoyed, I would suggest not even anything that's on a similar topic, because that would probably just get you hung up. But just in terms of how it's formatted, how it's structured, I always find very useful.
Yeah, I always think a paper that's doing the same thing in a different content area or different domain, because there's different ways you can theorize and you sort of want to be in the same way of theorizing, but not in the same content area, because then you just get distracted. So that's super helpful. Mm-hmm. Gina, anything to add? Any other little tips?
I guess, you know, the thing I think that really distinguishes a theory paper from an empirical paper, and Kemi alluded to this earlier, is the precision of the language needs to be so much more precise. So you need to be more precise in what you're trying to say, because there's no data to ground you. You can't look and see how do they operationalize this variable to see what it actually means. You have to really be sure of what you're saying, be very precise about what you're saying. And I think that we as a co-author team did a good job in that. We were able to talk about these things, push each other. And, you know, Kemi, as a first author, one thing she did keeping us on track that I appreciated so much was just being absolutely unflappable at all these things that are, you know, both Jamie and I can get very excited about things. And Kemi is very grounded and keeps us, you know, sort of on track, and at the same time is just very calm about it. So that is something that I really appreciated.
I think that was a duck on the pond situation. Calm on the surface, like doing this underneath.
Yeah. Well, for me to relate back my own relate back to the paper in some sense, I think this notion of precision, being precise, being fairly consistent in that precision, knowing what your boundaries are and are not, how you're defining things, and do your definitions flow through, is incredibly important. And I agree. So the accuracy, precision, value of the writing is critical. But at the same time, and this is where I'm going to go with the paradox of that, is you also need to have a pretty big idea, a bold idea, some idea that actually moves the needle, which, you know, and you can't do one without the other. If you've got a bold idea, but you're not precise enough in portraying it, the paper's not going to get through. If all you do is write very, very carefully, but the idea is just an incremental little shift, it's also not going to get through. And so you've got this paradox going on of keeping the a big idea front and center, but supporting it with clear, concise, precise writing. And so just to sort of build on that notion of paradox, I think that's important. Well, thank you. Thank you for being willing to share. Thank you for being the first author team that I get to interview in this next season or next iteration of the AMR Origin series. And thank you for being willing to share, to jump between the conceptual and the tactical, and to, you know, be so honest and open just about the process that you went through in developing this fascinating paper.
Thank you so much. We appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you.
Awesome.